The average housing in the city, you may think it looks lousy, but it looks lousy to you because you have a nice suburban home, which is a brand new development in human existence. You're up there on this lofty perch saying this other building in an urban area is not adequate, when in fact, that building is better than what people had 50 or 100 years ago to live in for the most part.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Marlo Slayback and Tom Saroof.
And we're joined today by Kevin Kosar, who's written the new introduction for a book by Ed Banfield. But before we get into anything about Ed Banfield, which this episode will primarily be about, Kevin, nice to meet you. Welcome to Conservative Conversations. And we'd love to start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you come from, your intellectual interests, your work.
Well, all right. Thanks for having me on. Geez, where to begin? Grew up in Ohio. Attended the Ohio State University. I was one of six kids. Got lucky, got a good fellowship, and went off to New York University. And over the course of a decade, I worked both to get my master's degree and doctorate, but also took some time off and was working for a not-for-profit in the city that was working in some of the toughest schools to be found. Lots of kids from rough situations, deep in poverty, that sort of thing. Did a dissertation on the politics of K-12 education policy in Congress and how it's grappled with it, and thought I was going to be an academic. But lo and behold, I got lucky and got a position at the Library of Congress, and it perhaps saved me from the torments of the academic life, which are many these days. And so for 20 years now, I've been here in Washington, D.C., doing think tankery, first for the government and more recently for the private sector.
Hey there, listener. I wanted to take a quick moment to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and our mission here at ISI is educating for liberty. If you'd like to join us in fulfilling our mission, consider helping us by rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, to help us reach more listeners like yourself. Now, back to the show. Awesome. Well, I mean, to start, like I mentioned at the beginning, we're talking about Ed Banfield. And as I was telling you before we started recording, I don't really know anything about Ed Banfield. I sort of know his name and the lineage of conservative intellectuals, but personally, about his work, I've not read anything by him. So this is, I don't know about Marlo, but this is, I think, a good introductory episode for everyone. But to start, could you tell us who Ed Banfield is?
Sure. He was a social scientist who spent most of his career at Harvard, a little bit of time at University of Pennsylvania, was trained at the University of Chicago. He produced some very famous students, James Q. Wilson, author of books like The Moral Sense and many others, Martha Derthick, great scholar of federalism. But Ed was a guy who was born to modest beginnings in Connecticut back in 1916. Initially, when he was coming out of high school, he thought he was going to be a farmer. Was interested in agricultural sciences. Started college studying that, and then toggled over to English. And after 4 years, he joined the New Deal. He was an ardent New Dealer. He was working for the Timber Salvage Administration, and later he worked for the Farm Security Administration. And his job was basically to write press releases and to promote the New Deal to the public via the media. But along the way, Ed got the chance to visit this government project out in Casa Grande, this cooperative farm that was created. And he started to rethink the New Deal. And he started to rethink all of his assumptions about how difficult it is to use the federal government to achieve things. And so he produced more than a dozen books over the course of his career on a whole variety of topics. A lot of them focused on urban areas and housing. But he also wrote essays on the American founding, the nature of political parties, American constitutionalism. I mean, he was a polymath, that's for sure.
So where would you say he he stood in the context at the time that his thought was coming together. What was the right of center conservative? I don't even think at that point it had quite concretized into a, you know, coherent movement quite yet. But maybe I'm just getting the timeline wrong, but what was the context of when he started, you know, becoming kind of changing his, or maybe forming his attitudes of the New Deal and some of the downstream effects?
Well, so he was out working for the government, looking at this project in Arizona, this cooperative farm, which on paper made a whole lot of sense and which seemed like it was bound to succeed. But then the thing collapsed and a lot of policymakers were stunned by it. And I think Ed was stunned by it because you had taken a bunch of people who were very poor and you had given them homes, a brand new built community, community center, regular paying jobs, and an equity stake in a giant farm that covered thousands of acres. And the people ultimately decided to walk away from it. And seeing that stunning lesson that, you know, simple material redistribution is not enough to make people happy, that human nature is very complex, that got Ed to thinking. And it was a problem he thought about through the whole of his career, which is how do you get people to cooperate for their own benefit, whether you should do it through government or through markets or voluntary organizations. How do we make that happen? And Ed was getting into this intellectual stuff at the U of Chicago at the same time Leo Strauss was there. Frank Knight, who did a lot of work on how to think about risk and human behavior. There are a lot of sociologists who they didn't identify as conservative, but nonetheless, they're very realistic portrayals of how the dynamics of human beings interacting on the streets of big cities worked, the various games they played with one another, the way they kept the peace amongst each other through these mores and customs and habits. He was soaking up all this stuff. And I've argued that he was basically the first of the domestic neocons, if you define a neoconservative as a liberal who got mugged by reality. Because that's what happened with Ed. He was way into the New Deal, but then he just saw, like, the facts show on the ground, this isn't working. And so Ed kind of was at the forefront of getting conservatives to make evidence-based arguments about the limited capacity of the federal government to do stuff and the various ways that government efforts can go haywire.
I'd be curious to hear more about why. So this, his first book, which has recently been reissued, you wrote, I know you wrote the intro for it. I've not had a chance to read this book, but it sounds interesting. So I think I probably will. You wrote the intro. It's about this government project in Arizona that you're talking about. So if they have housing, food, equity in this large farm, what was the reason he gave, or like, what was his analysis for why people would walk away from that?
Well, for one, the whole operation was based upon the notion of voluntary cooperation for the greater good. But the people there very quickly fell into factions, which anybody who's read James Madison knows they're pretty natural. And frequently they form along class lines. And they formed along class lines there, but they also formed along personalities, different cliques of people. And these individuals were kind of struggling for power with one another over very basic decisions. Like on a farm, there's a whole diversity of work to do. Some of it's pretty tough, like picking cotton. Other stuff, like riding on the tractor while other people are breaking their backs, bending over, that's a little more attractive job. How do you decide who gets to do that work? Economics suggests that people should specialize in their activity, that you just don't rotate people from position to position to position every day. But that would have been the fair thing to do, to move people around. But people didn't want to move around. They wanted to jockey for the better positions and the worst positions. They jockeyed over a whole lot of stuff. Like if they projected a profit would be coming, should they up their wages more immediately? Or should they wait to the end of the year and distribute it as a bonus? They fought over that. they fought over whether the federal government was being too directive in telling them how to run the government project. And ultimately, Ed says that you had a lot of people who were in a very existentially anxious condition because they had been plopped in the middle of, not a desert, but pretty barren land, and told, you guys are a community, cooperate. It was a little Soviet in its nature. They had no shared history. These people didn't know each other. They had no shared religious commitments that could bind them to one another. They were all strangers just thrown together in an aggregation. And it made it hard for them to cooperate. Most of them had lived their entire lives as very free people. Either they were migrants moving from place to place, doing what they wanted, or they were self-driven individuals who like took a job and then quit the job and did some other job. To be forced to be kind of rooted in a spot and told what to do, when in fact they didn't want to be told what to do. Those are the factors that brought the whole farm down.
What I'm hearing sounds like a lot of sociological observation, which reminds me a little bit of Nisbet's quest for community. Some of what you're saying about his observations about this, you know, forced communities where people have no sort of commitments that align with each other's, or, and of course that's inorganic, so it's probably not going to cohere as well as an organic community would when it's foisted upon individuals. How would you say, for maybe listeners who are familiar with some of the other, especially in the ISI orbit, Nisbet's a big name, and there's a few other other conservative thinkers who remark on community and why organically created communities are ones that, especially when we're talking about the localists and the localist approach and the subsidiarity approach to localism, these are really important for functioning economies and economies of scale. So how would you say Banfield's thought, it sounds like he was professionally a political scientist, but how would you say maybe these sociological observations helped animate his larger, I guess, corpus of thinking? And is there anyone else maybe that was maybe any, you know, big names in the movement, or maybe who were kind of at these elite institutions that it sounds like he was a part of, that maybe he, you know, had similar ideas as, or maybe that collaborated with him in some way, or that people frequently compare him to, that maybe listeners would be familiar with?
Oh, yeah. Marlo, you're totally right on. Nisbet, perfect. Yeah. If I can, let me just read you this little short quote, because Ed was on to something 100 years ago that I think has become really of intense interest amongst conservative thinkers today. It got very hot mid-century, then people kind of drifted away and quit thinking about it so much, and now it's hot again. So in the beginning of Government Project, he wrote that the most characteristic feature of modern society, perhaps, is the great and increasing role of formal organizations of all kind. Primitive societies were and are held together chiefly by the non-logical bounds of custom and tradition. In modern society, the relations of individuals are to a large extent consciously and deliberately organized by the use of intelligence and the rules of logic. This attempt to organize society along rational lines is a stupendous experiment. Nothing in history promises it will succeed, but like Faust, we are bound by our bargain. Yeah, I mean, we are humans. We have animal characteristics. We have very conflicted natures. And for thousands of years, we've been able to bind ourselves to one another, create identities, local cultures, through a variety of means. Traditions, rituals, religious affiliations, even fashion. I mean, so many things. And in their New Deal, with the kind of various movements of federal government policy that verged on collectivism, all those things were just being discarded. It was as if, you know, they imagined they could just take human beings and rationally order them and create a material carrot dangling in front of them. Just cooperate. Behave the way you should behave. And you'll be materially satisfied. Yeah, you get flashbacks of Dostoevsky talking about the effort to create a human anthill. This collision between rationalism taken to certain extremes and everything being spun out as rules from irreligious or even some would argue anti-religious authorities as a vehicle for binding people together. Ed was tapping into that theme. And other thinkers have obviously taken that much further. I mean, you know, my friend Andy Smerick over at Manhattan Institute has been very getting into this idea of localism, identity, subsidiary. I mean, it's a pushback to some degree against the globalism and stripping away of local identities and the feeling of disruption of communities. I mean, seems like almost everybody's talking about it. J.D. Vance, I mean, it's all there. But yeah, I would go back and I would say Nisbet. Nisbet is key. But there were also, with Ed's kind of early intellectual formation, the University of Chicago sociologist, Edward Schills was one of them. There was a guy with the last name of White, W-H-Y-T-E, who wrote about street corner society and how the people interacted and how that if you want to understand them, you've got to get into their belief systems. You have to understand their various ideas of what constitutes honor and dishonor. You have to see the religion inside their hearts. Even if they won't go to church, it's still there in some way, shape, or form, and it's very directive. And creates moral boundaries, which can create lines of conflict, but also moral duties. And so, yeah. Ed was well within that tradition. He was an empiricist who thought that if you're going to make policy and try to make things better, you have to know people as the people they are, not abstractions.
It reminds me, this conversation reminds me of, or what it sounds like is community is formed by, it's not rational, it's fraternal, it's based on various loves and commitments that are pre-rational, or I mean, Burke calls them prescriptive. And so I'm wondering, because you mentioned he has done some writing on the founding and the Constitution, is within the political theory of the founding, and this, I think, especially with various stripes of Straussians, maybe not Strauss himself, there's an emphasis on the rationality of the founding project and the use of reason in understanding what a man is and how that leads him to form political community and how the founding is not a rationalist project necessarily, like in the Cartesian sense, but very much with an emphasis on man, the use of man's reason towards achieving political ends. So I'm wondering that maybe there's this tension. I'm wondering what you and what Ed would have thought about this.
Yeah, well, certainly Ed had a deep affection for the American system. And I think one of the things that he relentlessly pointed to as a genius of the American system is the fragmentation of authority. It's a federal system. It's a separation of powers system. You have branches, not just with separate functions to fill, but often sharing functions, like the Congress and the president have to together make a law. They have to together appoint somebody to the high court, etc. And the reason for doing that is human nature. People cannot be trusted to be angels, which is something that James Madison and the founders harped upon. And Ed was very frank in recognizing that. I mean, he had seen the kind of excess and arrogance of the New Deal in various way, where even if it was good-hearted, some of these attempts to make society better, it involved very partial, very imperfect human beings with limited reason, with biases built in, with insufficient information, you know, kind of a Hayekian understanding, same things the founders understood. And that ultimately, you know, a big lesson to be drawn is realizing human beings are limited in their capacity, limited in their reason, that they're partial, that they're quarrelsome, that they can get arrogant, that they can have power struggles with one another about that are more about vanity than the substance of the matter. Realizing all these things about human beings, realizing that we built a system to fragment power, you should therefore, if you're logical, expect far less from government, because it's not built to deliver stupendous rational schemes. It's structured in a way that doesn't make it capable of doing that, with rare exception. So Ed, funny enough, he wrote an essay called, you know, "Was the American Founding an Accident?" He thought it was a very fraught moment. He was not somebody of a Hegelian stripe who thought that this was the cresting of the development of mind, nous, or something grand like that, that was culminating and the hand of, you know, providence was guiding it in that direction. He saw it as a very fraught thing, which is all the more reason to cherish it. And he also was a guy who was a fan of parties and politics. You know, I think it's very easy for us to dislike parties. It's very easy for us to despise politicians who talk out of both sides of their mouth and engage in this symbolic behavior. And there's always something a little slippery about them. Well, Ed studied these people close up, and he said, these people are essential. I mean, parties help create collective action. They help get people to put their dukes down and to kind of work together, even if it's in a tribal sort of way. And politicians, their essential job is to get unum out of e pluribus. It's to get enough people, a majority, to agree to be able to collectively act in some way, shape, or form. And if that means talking out of both sides of your mouth and being a little slimy in the process, that's what you got to do. Because otherwise, you're not going to be able to persuade people based upon just facts and reason, because most people don't operate that way.
Mm.
So to get into the topic of some of his written work, one book of his, one piece of work that he published, The Moral Basis of Backward Society, which I briefly read up on. But what's really interesting is just kind of reading the summary is, and I'd love to hear more, he focuses on how poverty is actually a result of the inability to trust or associate strongly outside of the immediate family. And he uses Southern Italy as a case study in 1955. I would love to hear more about, first of all, what was kind of his conclusions, and why did he use Southern Italy at this period of time? I'm especially interested because that's around the same time that they're just kind of as a cultural, you know, contextually, to maybe bring some listeners in. That's also around the same time that we're starting to get movies like The Godfather, right? So I'm imagining the Corleone family in Southern Italy and in Sicily. And so I'd love to hear more about why he chose that as a case study of all places, and how that helped support that theory.
Yeah, well, Ed was married to a woman formerly known as Laura Fasano, whose family migrated over from Italy. And so Ed had this idea about thinking about cooperation. And one thing he was doing after Government Project was he was hanging around out in Utah looking at the Mormons and marveling at the level of cooperation and the communal cohesiveness and the just the way that they seemed to be, just seemed to have everything together so very well. But his wife, who was from Italy, could tell him about another place that was in very much in contrast. And so they decided to take a trip and go take a firsthand look at this community over in Italy. And he got there and did firsthand sociology. And, you know, his wife spoke Italian, so she was able to translate for him. He took lots of photographs and gobs of notes. And the book, you know, its title your listeners may have picked up on it, you know, the moral basis of a backwards society. We usually think that if you have a strong shared moral code, that it's going to lead to prosperity. Like, for example, it has in Mormon communities. But what Ed found is kind of the Aristotelian lesson, which is all things in moderation. take something good to excess, it can actually be a vice. And what he saw there was that people were so fixated on their families that they were unable to develop trust bonds outside them, which meant they couldn't cooperate. You couldn't engage in material transaction. And so their ability to develop an economy and to self-govern, it just froze up. They were stuck in just a crushing sort of poverty. It wasn't that they were openly violent towards each other on a regular basis. This was not a gangster sort of situation, but it was just a profound distrust. Every time somebody wanted to be the mayor or hold the council position, the operating assumption was, well, he's going to pick my pocket. He's going to loot me in some way, shape, or form. I can't trust a word coming out of his mouth. And whatever they say passes rules, we're going to just kind of ignore unless they hassle us. And so there was just the collective action just couldn't occur. Basic things like how do you share land? How do you create basic rules for the community? They were just a bunch of family tribes. This way of looking at people and their inability, how their inner beliefs can affect their material success, their overall happiness. I mean, he carried this over when he started looking at the inner city and when he did books like, you know, The Unheavenly City, which looked at the kind of urban crisis of the late 60s that was being declared. And he looked at communities where gobs and gobs of money were being poured in by the government for the sake of solving the problems. And what he said is, you know, a lot of people there just don't want to get along. And dumping money on them is not going to make them like one another or trust one another more, nor is it going to make them want to go and hold a steady job or do any of the other sort of things that you have to do. There's an inner problem that is creating these external problems in part.
So follow-up question, what do you think his analysis would be today, where I think we all more or less agree in at least America, we live in a pretty low trust society. And I was thinking about this the other day and kind of talking to my husband about elements of like old Christmas movies that bring back the sense of great nostalgia and people today, even people who didn't live in, you know, the late 1980s, I'm thinking National Lampoon, Home Alone. And I recall, you know, friends and commentary, you know, people saying, that's not the world we live in it anymore. It's not a high trust society. People are extremely tribal. Where we live in a very polarized country where an election is like every single one is very historic, obviously, but the next one's more historic than the previous ones. There's always kind of a almost catastrophic, like there's always a kind of catastrophic risk that comes along with them, where I think a lot of people are genuinely worried about what's going to happen after an election now. But we also, you know, we are arguably the most prosperous country in the history of the world, and the most prosperous society in the history of the world, irrelevant of, you know, obviously inflation, which is maybe dampening down some of the innovation and lifestyle comforts that we maybe previously enjoyed, you know, several years ago when that wasn't as much the case. But it still seems to me like perhaps there are elements of clannishness and even it almost seems to be coming from both directions, where people are also low trust among people of different tribes, I guess we'll say. So people from, you know, we'll just say political parties alone. But also we are really bad at family formation right now. And the total fertility rate is obviously a topic, a commonly discussed topic now, where people aren't having large enough families, perhaps like they were in Italy in 1955. So what do you think, if Banfield was to look at America 2024, what do you think he would, what would be his analysis?
Well, it'd probably be kind of a collection of mixed observations. It's interesting, the points you were bringing up are all things that he's touched upon in ways. First thing, regarding the kind of feeling that like existential conflict of the nation each time we have a presidential election, he would probably point out that, you know, yeah, politics by its nature is rough and tumble and it is inherently conflictual. However, by growing the scope of the federal government, what you're doing is you're taking issues on which there's not necessarily shared belief across the country or even anything close to a majority, and you're trying to force a conversation on that. And don't be surprised if it gets nasty. You know, things that formerly might have been handled at the state or municipal or town level, now we're trying to have national conversations about them. And the politicians who are involved very frequently are not really interested in having a conversation. They're interested in using an issue for branding purposes and for election purposes. They want to own the issue, not solve the problem. So that would be one of his observations. He would also probably point out, you mentioned prosperity. That was a big thing for him. He said that there's something about human nature where people can have improved material conditions, but the joy they get from it, they very quickly quit noticing. They still like to have things like washing machines as opposed to having to wash your clothes by hands and any number of amenities. But the joy they get from those kind of gets baked in and they no longer cherish these things. These become kind of the new baseline and then they're going to want more. And it's kind of a, I don't know, a trap of some sort where people, despite things getting materially better, are often still dissatisfied. And think that they are somehow impoverished. When Ed was looking at cities, one of the things he tried to explain to the liberals in the late 60s who were saying, you know, our cities are in terrible shape, he said, no, like the average housing in the city, you may think it looks lousy, but it looks lousy to you because you have a nice suburban home, which is a brand new development in human existence. You're up there on this lofty perch saying this other building in an urban area is not adequate, when in fact, that building is better than what people had 50 or 100 years ago to live in for the most part. And that partiality and that tendency to get caught in the today and to not be able to see things for what they are, he would flag that. On fertility, he would certainly say, look, this is troubling. People having fewer children is probably going to be a catastrophe in the long run. But it's probably driven by the fact that the sort of traditional mores, which made childbearing, you know, the ultimate goal, family formation and childbearing is something that to be cherished and held above all other things, those have just melted away. And the kind of individual rational pursuit of self-actualization, prosperity, whatever it may be, has crowded that out. And that means, yeah, bearing kids is just personal choice, an afterthought. Nobody necessarily feels like they have to do it, not to the degree that they used to.
Kevin, I think we're starting to come towards the end of our time, but I'd love to know, I feel like we are probably can guess what he thought about the Great Society, which I think in many ways is the New Deal on steroids. Maybe a debate about, you know, but that's sort of an academic debate about, you know, which one is more significant, the New Deal or the Great Society. You mentioned to us via email that Ed was an early victim of campus culture at Harvard. I'd love to know what happened. And then also, as yourself, you mentioned at the beginning that you thought you were going to become an academic, but you went into the think tank world. And that you're glad that you did that. I'd love to hear more from your own perspective as well about the state of the academy and some of the things going on campus and what you see as, I guess, a scholar who's an outsider in the academy as to, you know, maybe whether it's advice for students who might be thinking about the academy or, you know, academics who are already in who are dissatisfied, what your perspective is there.
Yeah, the life of the mind means being able to think freely and follow leads wherever they may go, and to discuss them and to figure things out. And doing that also in conversation with others is essential. We all learn from one another. But many campuses, we've gotten to a place where that sort of intellectual wandering has become very dangerous. It's like there's mines everywhere, and you risk stepping on one of those and being taken down. And thanks to the internet, you know, all it takes is, and thanks to technology, all it takes is following a thought out loud, somebody happening to hear it and then decide to tweet about it, and you could suddenly find yourself tens of thousands of emails pouring in, yourself getting doxxed, your home phone being rung at all hours of the day. Like it's a crazy, unhealthy situation. And campuses is, it seems like where the landmines are most dense in terms of the sheer numbers per square foot. Whereas in think tank world, that's not so. Certainly not here at the American Enterprise Institute, where we're free to think and we're also free to argue amongst ourselves. There's no company line. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. You know, I thought I was going to be a professor, but, you know, working with Congress at the Library of Congress, first couple of years, I was still looking for an academic job. And then I just quit looking for one because, here I was in Washington, D.C., getting to study policymakers close up without having to join either the Democrats or the Republicans. I could just be objective and see what they do and scratch my head and ask questions and collect data. It's great. It's great. But yeah, Ed was canceled on campus. He was canceled because he had the guts to follow the data. He would do things like look at data on job retraining programs. He would look at data on crime. He would look at all sorts of numbers, and he would compile them, he'd crunch them, and then he'd put it out there and says, this is what they suggest to me. And that didn't work with the reigning liberal orthodoxy at the time. This was a time of peaking student radicalism on campus. This was a time where essentially you had folks condemning the United States as just an inherently racist, patriarchal, hierarchical project that aims to keep, you know, women and non-whites down, and that the reason we had rough urban areas was that it was essentially a plot. The ghettos were something that were created, and the reason that cities are, you know, having troubles is, you know, it all flows from bad decisions made by the powers that be. And Ed was like, no, it's a little more complex than that. And as far as fixing these things, it's even more complex to try to fix these things or improve these things. And yeah, he had students who, you know, would come into his classroom and disrupt teaching. When he gave public lectures, you know, they shut him down by flooding the hall. He got so frustrated by the harassment he faced at Harvard that he moved to the University of Pennsylvania. But then he only stayed there for a couple of years because one of the ringleaders of the radicals at Harvard got kicked out of Harvard, applied to UPenn just to harass him some more. And she showed up there and was harassing him there. And he finally threw up his hands and was like, I'm going back to Harvard, because UPenn was not able to police the situation and get her under control. So it was bad. He was denounced as a racist and a totalitarian. I mean, it was all just bonkers what they were accusing this guy of. And he was, as it turns out, a kind of early sign of what was to come.
I was going to say, it sounds like almost nothing has changed in however many years it's been.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Ed's book, The Unheavenly City, it was excerpted in New York Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, some other places. And, you know, if he had just published with an academic press instead of Little Brown and then not done much to promote the book, you know, maybe he could avoid some of that grief. But he thought he had something very important to say. And so he spoke up and he paid for it.
Well, Kevin, this has been a great introduction to the work of Ed Banfield. We have quite a few texts that we'll put in our show notes for our students and our listeners to go and read and check out. But if there's anything else that you think our listeners should look at, whether it's your work as a scholar or other things of Ed's that you think are worthwhile, what would you recommend?
Well, I about 10 or 15 years ago, I created a website, edwardcbanfield.org, where I've collected most of his works, some of which are available free for download right on the site. Along with, you know, old videos and audio recordings of him. So it's kind of like a one-stop shopping place for that. Otherwise, for those of you out there who are interested in collective action in the form of legislative politicking and how do you bring together representatives from across the country, you can either follow me on at Kevin R. Kosar on Twitter or X. Or check out the site I launched called understandingcongress.org, where I try to think through the complexities of getting 535 people who represent diverse populations to come together for the collective good.
Well, awesome. We'll put all of that in our show notes for our listeners to go peruse. But thanks again, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out our website at isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, select Modern Age articles, debates, lectures, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.